Good morning and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. My name is Kathy Gorski. I am this morning's board rep. Welcome on this seasonally pleasant day. I have actually just a few announcements to make, which is rather amazing. There is nothing on the pile, but I want to call your attention to two things, and then one other person wants to make a brief announcement. I wanted to remind everyone that today is the last day to sign up for the Thanksgiving meal and to indicate to Barb Adams the number of people who you will be bringing and also the dish that you will bring. The sign up for numbers of people wasn't there originally, so if you just signed your name and your dish, it would be helpful to let Barbara know how many people are actually coming. So please, it's a wonderful event. If you haven't signed up for your participation, do so today after the service. Also, I believe there's spots for a few more people to volunteer to make cookies for the great cookie sale. So I'm assuming that there's a sign-up that will be out in the hall for that. There are several other announcements that are in the order of service, so I ask you to look through that and take it home with you so that you're reminded of what they are. And I believe Eric Larson has an announcement.
Children, really important rehearsal today for the children's choir. Really special rehearsal today. So I hope you come. We're going to sing in the service next week. Parents of children, bring your kids at 9:30 next week, please, because we're going to have a rehearsal before we perform.
Come to children's choir.
How can you say no to something like that? Okay. And we all look forward to hearing the children's choir. I now invite you to greet those sitting around you.
Again, look at how far I am. No. And I feel like when I finish, like, team in my room, because I've done it all.
Hey, wake up.
I still have your dinner.
If you are visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. We hope that you'll sign the guest ledger out in the foyer, and there's also a lot of information out there about our church and Unitarian Universalism, which you are encouraged to take with you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you've been visiting for a while and would like to speak about becoming a member, I'd be happy to speak with you about that as well. If you are visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the story for all ages, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, you are more than welcome to do so. The nursery is just outside the store and across the hall in case you have a child who would benefit from being in the nursery. Classes end at 11:15, at which time you can pick your children up from their classes. We always enjoy getting to know guests who come to our church. If any members have brought guests and would like to introduce them, that would be wonderful. Or if you have brought yourself and would like to just stand and introduce yourself, we will welcome you.
Hi, I'm here to work with the high schoolers today. I'm Pat Pilati. I teach Tai Chi.
Well, I know that. Welcome. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right in front of me. I didn't see you.
I'm Joan, and I'm from Florida. I'm Sarah's mother, and Chris.
I'm Chris. I'm Sarah's husband.
Welcome. Okay, am I missing anyone else right in front of me? No, okay. Everyone is invited to the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. Please put your cell phones and other noisemakers on silent mode. Our speaker today is the Reverend Callan Freestad, and his topic, the title is Universalism, Past, Present, and Powerful. Callan Freestad is a United Methodist minister from Iowa. He wrote a book on the subject of universalism, and he, along with his wife Dolores, or rather Darlene, I'm sorry, have traveled full-time speaking on universalism. They did this from 2003 to 2006. Cannon now serves small churches in Iowa half-time while traveling and speaking half-time. And he has spoken at a number of Unitarian Universalist churches in the area. Also, his books, CDs, and DVDs will be available in the social hall after the service for anyone who may be interested. I hope that you find this morning's service inspiring. Thank you.
And inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we once again know that we are not isolated human beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our power to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom. Our opening hymn is number 1008 in the new hymnal, and please rise as you're willing and able. our speaker today, he's going to speak to us about universalism, which is half of our kind of our history. And universalism, one of the things it focuses on is goodness, so of people. And so do you think you guys are all are good, or are you bad? Good? Okay. Well, this story is about a little girl who also is good. It's called Ribbon Rescue. As soon as her grandmother finished making the ribbon dress, Jillian put it on and ran out into the front yard. So she's got a really pretty dress there. A man came running down the road. He was dressed in fancy clothes and he was yelling, "I'm late, I'm lost, I'm late, I'm lost, I'm going to miss my own wedding." "Wait," said Jillian, "let me fix your shoes." She tore two ribbons off of her dress, laced up the man's shoes with those laces, and tied them into big bows. The man said, "Thanks, I may be late, but I'll look fine." "Well," said Jillian, "why don't you take my brother Lewis's skateboard? He's grown up and doesn't use it anymore. Just keep your eye on the church steeple and you will get there." "Thank you," said the man. "I'll bring it back as soon as the wedding is over." Then a lady in a fancy white dress came running by. She was yelling, "I'm late, I'm lost, I'm late, I'm lost, I'm going to miss my own wedding." "Well," said Jillian, "at least I can fix your hair." Jillian reached up and tore 8 ribbons off her dress. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Then the lady bent down and Jillian fixed her hair into 4 enormous ponytails. "And now," said Jillian, "take my mother's bicycle. She's grown up and doesn't use it very much. Just keep heading for the church steeple and you'll be there in no time." "Oh, thank you," said the lady. "I might be late, but at least I will look okay." She gave Jillian a hug and rode away on the bicycle. Then a family came running down the road yelling, "We're late, we're lost, we're going to miss the wedding. We haven't even had time to wrap the present." "Well," said Jillian, "I can wrap your present," and she wrapped it with 5 ribbons from her dress. The family said, "Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. We may be late, but we will have a lovely present." "And now," said Jillian, "take Lindsay's wagon and Haley's scooter. They are sort of grown up and don't use them very much. Just keep heading for the church steeple and you'll not get lost." And they gave her a hug and raced off. And then a man came down the road yelling, "I'm late, I'm lost, I'm going to miss the wedding." Suddenly he stopped and said, "Oh no, it's lost." "What's lost?" said Jillian. "The ring, the wedding ring," said the man. "I've lost the ring." "I'll help you find it," said Jillian. She crawled around and got quite dirty, but after a while she found the ring in a mud puddle. "Look," said Jillian, "you might lose it again. Let me help you." She tied the ring to the man's finger with a ribbon. "And now," said Jillian, "take Jeremy's skates. He's grown up and doesn't use them very much. Just keep heading for the church steeple." "Thank you," said the man. "I may be late, but at least I'll have the ring." Then Jillian's grandmother came running out of the house yelling, "Jillian, we're late for a wedding and you're a mess. What will your grandmother say?" She grabbed Jillian's hand and they ran down the road. And when they got to the church, the man at the door said to Jillian, "What a mess. You can't come in here dressed like that." But, said her mother, "That's okay," said Jillian. "I will sit on the stairs and wait for you." Then the bride and the groom walked around the side of the church and saw Jillian sitting on the stairs. "Oh," said the groom, "don't my shoes look great?" "Oh," said the bride, "isn't my hair wonderful?" "Yes," said Jillian, "your shoes are great and your hair is wonderful, and I hope you have a wonderful wedding." "Aren't you coming in?" asked the groom. "No, Mama." "No," said Jillian, "I tore off all my ribbons to fix hair, lace shoes, wrap a present, and tie a ring. Now my dress is a mess and I can't come in." Hmm, said the groom. I think we need a flower girl. Said the bride, yes, we definitely need a flower girl. So they picked a bunch of wildflowers from the grass, and Jillian walked into the church in front of everybody else. And even though her dress was all dirty and full of holes, everyone said she was the prettiest kid there. And that's the end of our story. And so, now it's time for the kids to leave for their RE classes. So do we have a chosen person to carry the lamp? Thank you. Concerns that we've had from the week before, and if you want to give your name, and the usher will bring you the microphone and tell us your joy or concern. I'll light a candle for you. And I'll light the first candle, considering it's Veterans Day weekend, I'll light the memorial candle in memory of and honor of all our veterans.
My name is Gus, and my partner, Bruce Goodman, is going to be having major surgery tomorrow, and I'd like everybody to keep him in your thoughts. Good graces, good karma, prayers, whatever it is that you do, just send good energy his way. Thank you.
I'm Janice, and a candle of joy for our high school class. We have six of them today that are spending the weekend in Wausau, a youth con with a larger community, and really excited for what they're bringing back to us. But for the group, it's a wonderful, vibrant group of high school kids, and they're involved, and they make it a joy to be part of their group.
Hi, I'm Sonia. Could you light a candle of concern for my stepfather, who was diagnosed with an abdominal aneurysm last week, and will be going in for surgery on Tuesday?
Hi, I'm Tom. My daughter, Rosa, who's 21 now, and has taken membership classes and signed the book and is an adult member of the Hebrew Church in Brooklyn.
My name is Kirsten. I'd like you to light a candle of support for my mother, who is also a veteran. And even though her health remains fairly stable, I've been visiting her quite regularly. Her mind is definitely slipping, and one of her fondest memories was the fact that she was dating a Navy SEAL. She's turning 92 next week, by the way. And she's convinced that he's one of the persons that took out Osama bin Laden. So life is interesting visiting her.
My name is Terry. If you'd light a candle of concern for my nephew and his wife. He had an infant daughter who has Down syndrome, and she just had open heart surgery. So, Tori.
honest candle for the joys and concerns that we keep in our hearts today. We've just heard only a few of many joys and concerns among us. The joys in our lives would have much less meaning if we didn't also have concerns, and vice versa. Let's take a few moments of silent meditation to consider all that we've heard and to consider the unspoken as well. May our collective thoughts bring us all closer together. Join in our hymn number 1002. Okay. Remain seated.
Thank you.
We have a reading this morning, and it's written by the father of American Universalism. His name is Hosea Ballou. It was written around 1849, and it's 4 points that were excerpted out of something he wrote called A Short Essay. So the first point, it's a little bit, the language, you know, 150 years ago or whatever, it's just a little bit hard to follow the language, but bear with me. As respects the one central idea in which all who have ever professed to believe the doctrine have agreed, this great and paramount idea embraces the final end of all sin in the human family and the consequent holiness and happiness of all men. We deem it proper to consider all who embrace this one item of faith as universalists, however they may differ in regard to the ways and means which have been, or may be, used to carry into effect the desired and glorious result, or however they may differ as to times and seasons in which divine wisdom may accomplish it. This item of faith evidently distinguishes all its advocates from all who believe that any of the human family will sin and suffer as long as the Creator shall exist. Second, there is another item in the belief entertained by Universalists in which all its advocates are agreed, and that is that this great and glorious truth has its origin in the nature of God and is a necessary result flowing from all the divine attributes, which harmonize in infinite, unchangeable love. As it is manifestly unreasonable to suppose that there can exist in any one of the divine attributes a tendency which conflicts with that of any other attribute, so it is equally unreasonable to allow that the divine justice can require any punishment or retribution which divine love does not desire. That the good of the subject is the object is the necessary conclusion. Third, all Universalists agree in the belief that their distinguishing doctrine is plainly taught by divine inspiration in the scriptures of Old and the New Testaments, and of course they do not believe that the inspired scriptures anywhere express a contrary doctrine. They find this doctrine in the writings of Moses, in the prophets, and in the Psalms, and most clearly set forth in the teachings of Jesus and his apostles. The very spirit of the gospel of the Son of God is that of love to enemies and the rendering of good for evil. And last, number four, all Universalists agree in believing that the true Christian life consists in possessing, living, and acting the spirit of love as manifested in the life and teachings of the Divine Master. And however we may fail or come short of this rule, even our delinquencies admonish us of its purity and compel us to acknowledge it.
It's a great privilege and a pleasure to be with you today. I love UU churches, and I've spoken at a lot of them around the country. In fact, I've spoken at more than 100 UU churches around the country. I think about maybe a half a dozen or more in the state of Wisconsin so far. And my goal is to speak at UU churches in all 50 states, including Alaska and Hawaii, obviously. And I have not made it to those distant ones yet, but that's the plan, to speak in all states. I have a friend in England who suggested that I might set a goal of speaking in all of the counties in the United Kingdom as well. And that would be quite a feat in order to accomplish that. But anyway, I love UU churches with the diversity and respect for diversity. One of the things that sets UU churches apart from others is that many other churches tolerate diversity, you celebrate it. And that is something that's really important, I think. When I served the United Methodist Church in Dallas Center, Iowa, I became acquainted with the UU minister in Des Moines. And when she realized that I believed in Universalism, she invited me to attend a special service that their church is going to be having. And it was going to be in the small town of Mitchellville, which is just east of Des Moines. And it was also to be in a church building that was originally a Universalist church. There's not a congregation there anymore. But they had the tradition of having one service there each summer, the Des Moines church, one service there each summer as a way of celebrating their Universalist heritage. So I was happy to accept her invitation to join them for that service. And I'll always remember as I walked up the walk in front of that church, over the door it read, Universalist Church. And I thought, I have arrived at home. Universalism has been really important to me for a long time, and as a result, I wrote a book on the subject and spent 3 years full-time traveling from 2003 to 2006, speaking on Universalism, living in our travel trailer. And now we're in our fourth year of serving little churches in Iowa half-time and on the road half of the time as well, speaking on Universalism. Today I'm going to be speaking on the history and the significance of the teaching of Universalism. It is sometimes referred to as universal salvation, and so I'd like to offer a definition of salvation that is different, perhaps, from what you've heard elsewhere. You're probably aware that, at least among evangelical or conservative Christians, the definition of salvation would be to accept Jesus as your personal Savior so you can go to heaven when you die. Well, I believe that's not a very adequate understanding of salvation. And so a definition that I've come up with that works for me is that salvation is to learn and grow, either with or without divine influence, so as to experience fullness of life in this life and beyond. And if you don't believe in the divine, or if you don't believe in life after death, then you can just leave those parts off the definition. And so to me, salvation, the most basic definition of salvation, is to learn and grow so as to experience fullness of life. So in contrast to what a lot of people believe, I reject the idea that a lot of people will suffer forever in hell. Instead, I believe that everyone will eventually experience salvation or fullness of life. And if that doesn't take place in this life, I believe there will be opportunities beyond this life to experience that. During the time of the early church, it was commonly taught in the religions of the day that the vast majority of people would spend eternity suffering in hell. There were at least a couple exceptions, however. The Zoroastrians, for example, were universalists, and so they rejected that teaching. Jesus also, I believe, rejected the teaching of a God of eternal damnation, rejected the idea that a lot of people would suffer forever in hell. And I believe that's really clear from several passages in the Bible. In the environment, though, where the conventional wisdom of the day was that a lot of people would spend eternity suffering in hell, it was hard to convince people otherwise. And so there were people who were converted to Christianity and who professed to be followers of Jesus, but also held on to the belief of endless suffering of many people beyond death. But there were many, many people who were fully converted to Christianity. In other words, they came to believe in not only be followers of Jesus, but to profess a belief in Universalism. There was a Clement and Origen of Alexandria. They were probably the two most prominent leading theologians in the church for like the first 300 years following the time of Jesus. Others included Gregory of Nyssa, Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, and Jerome, who translated the Bible into Latin, which is known as the Vulgate. There were prominent women involved in leadership during the time of the early church, which is pretty revolutionary considering the status of women in those days. There was Macrina the Younger and Macrina the Elder, the grandmother and granddaughter. They were both strong Universalists and strong leaders in the church, in the early church. But it seems interesting that they weren't very imaginative when it came to naming the people in their family, Macrina the Elder and Macrina the Younger, or granddaughter. As I said, there were some people who weren't fully converted. Tertullian was one example of that. He became a Christian at age 40, and he held on to his belief of endless suffering of many people beyond death. In fact, Tertullian so relished the idea of people suffering in hell that he said he believed that one of the best things about heaven would be the superb view of the damned frying in hell. Now, doesn't the thought of that just make you feel good all over? Isn't that astonishing? A person who professed to be a follower of Jesus, a follower of the one who taught so much about love and compassion and peace and forgiveness and mercy and so on, could so relish the idea of so many people suffering excruciating torment in hell forever. The theologian Augustine was another example of a person who wasn't fully converted to Christianity. He became a Christian at age 32, and he also held on to his belief of endless suffering of many people beyond death. But Augustine was a pretty good theologian in some respects, and or probably many respects, many people would say. And as a result, his theology started to become dominant in the church. Not surprisingly, that led to division and controversy over the issue of universalism. And so in order to resolve this controversy over universalism, the Roman Emperor Justinian called a church meeting. It was the Fifth Ecumenical Council in the year 553. Now, does it seem a little strange to you that a Roman emperor would call a church meeting? Well, it makes perfect sense when you think about the fact that emperors like to control people, right? That's a given. Emperors like to control people. And the people had come to realize that threatening people with eternal damnation was a foolproof means of controlling them. And you see, if you can convince people that spending eternity in hell is a very real possibility, then you've got them where you want them. Because you can get them to do anything you want by threatening them with eternal damnation. Now, of course, that probably has a familiar ring to all of you, and that is because churches today still do that. A lot of churches, they still threaten people with eternal damnation as a means of controlling their members. Well, the problem back then, though, the emperor and the hellraisers of the day, those who advocated unending suffering of many people in hell, they were having trouble controlling those free-spirited universalists. They could threaten them with unending hell all they wanted, and they didn't take it seriously. And so out of frustration, the emperor allied himself together with the hellraisers, and together they pushed through a resolution which abolished the teaching of universalism. Well, it's not surprising, with all of the power of the church as well as the state against the teaching of universalism, the teaching pretty well died out after that, or went dormant or underground. And that lasted for a long time. Really, it lasted for about 1,000 years. But you can't suppress the truth indefinitely, right? Eventually, it'll start bubbling up someplace. And that's what happened about 300 years ago. It really started more than 300 years ago, but it was about 300 years ago that it started to become a strong movement once again. John Wesley, who was the primary leader and organizer of the Methodist movement back in the 18th century, had a close association with a group of Christians called the Moravians, and the Moravians were universalists. But in those early years, Wesley used to argue with them. He thought they were wrong. But Wesley continued his lifelong association with the Moravians, and it seems that they eventually wore him down, because Wesley, too, came to believe in universalism late in his life. Now, I love to tell United Methodists that Wesley came to believe in universalism eventually, and that is because in the United Methodist Church, the most conservative people are ones who are most likely to reject the teaching of universalism. At the same time, they can often be heard to say, let's go back and reestablish the teachings of John Wesley. And I say, yeah, let's do that, because he eventually came to believe in universalism. The American colonies proved to be a particularly fertile ground for the spread of the teaching of universalism. George de Benneville came over from France to Pennsylvania in 1741, and did a lot to spread the teaching there. John Murray came over from England in 1770, and he worked closely with the Quakers and the Baptists in spreading the teaching of universalism throughout the American colonies. It was under the leadership of John Murray that the Universalist Church in America was organized. As in the time of the early church, there were strong leaders among women in those early years of the Universalist Church in America. For example, there was Hannah Whitehall Smith and Olympia Brown, who was the first woman to be ordained by any denomination, in at least any major denomination, or maybe any at all. And she was ordained a minister in the year 1863 in the Universalist Church. And, I'm a United Methodist, and I thought we were doing pretty well because we started ordaining women in 1956. And I felt pretty good about that, until I discovered that the Universalists ordained Olympia Brown in 1863, almost 100 years sooner. And that is certainly something to celebrate. Hosea Ballou, who was mentioned earlier and was quoted earlier by John, he was the most prominent influential leader of the Universalist Church during his life and ministry. And when he died in 1852, the Universalist Church had about 800,000 members. So it was a strong movement, to be sure. But the teaching of universalism hasn't been advocated only by universalists or Unitarians, for that matter. It has been advocated by theologians and leaders of other denominations as well. For example, back in the 19th century, there was a German theologian named Friedrich Schleiermacher who advocated universalism. I wonder how many here have heard of old Friedrich. You are an above-average congregation, I'd say. Not very many people have heard of Friedrich. He's not a very well-known theologian, but he was a fine theologian and a strong advocate of universalism. And besides that, I'd just like to say his name. Friedrich Schleiermacher. I love that name. I think it is so cool. Then there were others as well in the 20th century, including who advocated that everybody eventually would experience fullness of life or salvation. Karl Barth, Paul Tillich, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Leslie Weatherhead, and many others. So the teaching of universalism has a long, rich history. For more than 500 years, think about that, that's a long time. For more than 500 years following the time of Jesus, and then again, especially in the last 300 years as well. So you might wonder, why is this teaching so important to me? Why would I, as a United Methodist minister, write a book on the subject and travel around speaking about it? Because unfortunately, that's really not our doctrine, the belief in universalism. We have in our book of discipline our articles of religion, and one of the articles clearly states that some people are going to go to heaven and others are going to go to hell, and that's what it's going to be for eternity. So why would I find myself swimming upstream and not my denomination? Well, obviously it's important to me. And the reason it's so important is because it seems to me that the teaching of a God of eternal damnation has prevailed for far too long in most churches and in our society at large, and with devastating consequences. One of the reasons this is so important to me is because the teaching of a God of eternal damnation turns many people away from God. People know that they would never, ever even consider punishing their own children without end. And so, because that's just an absurd concept even, to punish children without end. And so the idea of a God of eternal damnation, a God who does punish God's children without end, turns many, many people away from God. Sometimes they become atheists. Now, I need to acknowledge that I've learned a lot about atheism from UUs. And I'm grateful. When we went on the road in 2003, I thought I knew something about atheism, and of course I knew a little, but I didn't know much. But in these years since then, in about 8 years, I've been traveling, speaking around the country. I've met a lot of wonderful atheists in UU churches around the country. Of course, I've met a lot of wonderful people of a great variety of faiths in UU churches in all around the country. But in meeting atheists, I find that for many of them, they find it to be a thoughtful, responsible, mature way to approach life, and it works for them. And so for people for whom atheism works, I really don't have a difficulty with that. When people of other denominations, however, become atheists, it often is not such a positive thing. And that is because they still have in the back of their mind the possibility of spending eternity in hell, and if there is no God to rescue them from that plight, then they often conclude that they are doomed, and that often leads to despair and meaninglessness. In a lot of churches, people attend church only at Christmas and Easter, and there's a good reason for that. And that is because Christmas and Easter are two times of celebration, and on those two times of celebration, there's little danger that anyone's going to bring up the teaching of a God of eternal damnation. And so it's not that they're too lazy or too uncommitted to get up and go to church the rest of the Sundays. It's self-preservation. They've heard more damnation teaching than they care to hear about, and they don't want to hear anymore, and they're not going to put up with it anymore. And so they go to church only at Christmas and Easter, when there's little danger that anyone's going to bring up that awful teaching of a God of eternal damnation. Then there's perhaps close to half of the people in our country who don't go to church even at Christmas and Easter. And I've talked with an awful lot of unchurched people, and they so often bring up the idea of a God of eternal damnation, of unending suffering of people in hell, that it obviously is an issue that weighs heavily upon them. It seems that they just want to make a rebuttal against that teaching and hope somebody will agree with them and tell them that it ain't so. They seem to instinctively reject the idea of a monster God who throws people into hell kicking and screaming against their will, never again to listen to their pleas for mercy. And they also seem to reject the idea of a weak and a stupid and unloving God who, you know, just allows people to go through hell and go through life and of their own free will somehow end up in hell and then just to abandon them there. So what kind of a God is that? Either one of those two ideas or concepts of God. A monster God who throws people into hell to torture them because they were naughty. Or a weak and a stupid and uncaring God who either can't save everybody or who doesn't want to. So who in their right mind would want to serve either one of those kinds of gods? And so many people are not aware that there are progressive and open-minded United Methodist and Presbyterian, Lutheran and Episcopal and so on churches, as well as UU churches. They're not aware that there are churches that teach love instead of judgment, that teach hope instead of damnation, and so they drop out of church altogether. We all want to make the world a better place, and this is what motivates me more than anything else to travel around the country speaking on universalism. We all want to make the world a better place, but we're not likely to have much success in that regard as long as the teaching of a God of eternal damnation continues to prevail in most churches and in our society at large. And the reason for that is because people's perception of God has a powerful and direct influence on how they live their lives. If people believe that God is judgmental and condemning and cruel, it's very, very easy to justify living that same way themselves. It's like the old song, One Tin Soldier goes, "Go ahead and hate your neighbor. Go ahead and cheat a friend. Do it in the name of heaven. You can justify it in the end." Sadly, I see people in our own country and around the world every day seeking to justify evil behavior in the name of heaven, in the name of God. And it's much easier to do that if we believe that God is judgmental and condemning and cruel. On the other hand, if we believe that God is loving and kind and merciful and gracious and patient and nurturing, then we're much more likely to live that way ourselves. I believe this is of enormous significance. I believe if we're going to change the world for the better, perhaps the most important single thing that we need to do is to change people's perception of God. That is because it's very difficult for people's behavior to rise above their perception of God. So what we need to do is to change the perception of God from being judgmental and cruel to that of loving. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was sometimes criticized because he loved his enemies too much. He was told, "You shouldn't love your enemies, you should seek to destroy them." To which Lincoln replied, "Do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" Isn't that powerful? "Do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" Abraham Lincoln was a universalist. He rejected the teaching of a God of eternal damnation. He believed in the power of love and the preciousness of each individual and that everyone would eventually experience fullness of life, even his enemies. And what a difference that made in how he related to people and how he lived his life. We who believe, who are also universalists, who believe in the preciousness of each individual and the power of love, I believe are called to live the same way. And so we can rise above being judgmental and cruel to changing the world through love. So we who believe in universalism have a wonderful and a powerful message to share with the world, and it's really important that we do so. There's a man named Robert Short who wrote a book on universalism, a book entitled Something to Believe In. It's a wonderful book. But he says many things that are worth quoting in that book. But one of the things he says is that there is too much at stake for us to allow ourselves to be intimidated by the wrathful self-righteousness of the hell-raising gloomy doomies. That's quite a mouthful, isn't it? There's too much at stake for us to allow ourselves to be intimidated by the wrathful self-righteousness of the hell-raising gloomy doomies. Then he goes on to say, "Therefore, our witness to them should be just as aggressive and unambiguous as theirs has been to us." Fundamentalists can be intimidating, can't they? They go around quoting the Bible and asking people whether or not they're saved. They exhibit such confidence, so they can be intimidating. But I say, let's not be intimidated by them. After all, we are the ones with the good news to share with the world. They instead spread a teaching that is divisive and leads to cruel and inhumane behavior and justifies abuse. With the teaching of the fundamentalists, it really isn't that big of a deal to go to war and kill people of other faiths or people who don't have any faith at all. After all, they conclude that those people are all going to hell, and therefore they're really not as valuable as other people. You've probably noticed that, haven't you? Whenever a country goes to war, the number one thing or the first thing they do is to demonize the enemy. In my younger years, it was the godless communists in Vietnam that were going to kill. And because they were godless communists, that meant they were all going to hell, and therefore they weren't nearly as great a value as we were. And therefore, you've also noticed, I'm sure, that evangelical Christians find it much easier to justify war than do liberals. And I'm convinced that the reason why it's easier for them to justify war is because they believe all those people are going to hell. And so they're not as important, while liberals are inclined to think that we're all brothers and sisters. And why would we want to go and kill our brothers and sisters? Also, with the perception of the fundamentalists, it's really no big deal to torture people, whether that's at Guantanamo Bay or wherever. After all, they conclude that God fashioned hell specifically for the purpose of torturing naughty people forever. And if it's okay for God to torture people, surely it must be okay for us to do it. Besides, the torture that we might inflict upon others, whether that's waterboarding or whatever, is nothing compared to the torture that they say that God will inflict upon naughty people in a literal lake of fire forever, no less. So we who believe in love, who believe in the preciousness of each individual, and who are universalists, we have truly good news to share with the world. So it's important that we not be intimidated. The teaching of a God of eternal damnation leads to wars and racism and oppression and abuse, while the spread of the teaching of universalism leads to equality, respect, love, and dignity for all. So I say, let's not be intimidated. Instead, let us freely and boldly proclaim to the world the wonderful message of universalism, and the world will be infinitely better off because of it. Amen.
Into their life is doomed. And it just I don't know how that can make sense to so many people. So, but thank you. Thank you for your passages from the New Testament, which I'm not very well versed in. And maybe that will be something I can share.
Hi, Carolyn. This is Gus. You're the man. One of the things I always found problematic with theology was the internal dissent, or not dissent, but rather the internal struggle within the Trinity itself. That is to say, how could God the Father murder his own son? And, I realize that's putting it rather bluntly, but in fact, the salvific act makes no sense. That is to say, the death and resurrection makes no sense at all, unless one presupposes the sin and the eternal damnation, that at least some people can be saved from it. Otherwise, there was no point to it. And if Jesus, the man, was in fact a man, and also 100% man and 100% God, that there was obviously some kind of conflict that God the Father could determine, and that the Son would comply with that as God. So you've got a whole mess going on there, even within the Trinity itself, which, of course, is why Paul said that the whole notion of Jesus being a God-man was absurdity to the Greeks, who couldn't, make sense of that, and a blasphemy to the Jews.
Right. Yeah. I think what you say about God requiring that Jesus died in order to be willing to forgive others, how many of us require that somebody else die in order to be willing to forgive somebody else? That just doesn't make sense. And so I certainly reject the idea of the substitutionary atonement, where Christ died and therefore we all are saved because of what Christ did on our behalf, and that God required that. I just have real difficulty with that, so thanks for bringing that up.
My name is Tom, and this is actually a question. I know that a lot of one of the Universalist churches became part of the Unitarian Universalist Association, and that's half of our heritage. But where else on the denominational map have Universalists survived to this day? I believe there's a Universalist group within the Quaker Church as well. I don't know where else, but that's my question.
Okay. Yes, there are Quaker Universalists, beyond that, the Lutheran Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which is a merger of several, they have it in their doctrine now that it's okay to believe in universalism. They say you don't have to, but if you want to and choose to, then that's okay. So that's a big step in the right direction. But the vast, like United Church of Christ, Episcopal are two examples, and there are more progressive United Methodist and other, progressive churches of other denominations where people often believe in universalism. It's not an official doctrine. Back in the early times, at the time of Jose Ballou, John Murray, and so on. See, John Murray was a contemporary of Jonathan Edwards. And, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God is his most famous sermon, which is just atrocious theology. But back then, there was such an enormous contrast between all the damnation teaching that was prevalent in virtually all the other churches and the Universalists. That's one of the reasons why the Universalist Church grew as rapidly as it did, because it was such a breath of fresh air compared to the atrocious theology that so many other people believed in. And also back at that time, if you came to believe in Universalism, you were no longer welcome in your church, and so for the most part. And so you had to leave if you believed in Universalism, and the only place to go was the Universalist Church. And so that helped them to grow. Now, as you see, Southern Baptist and some others would be an example of if you become a Universalist, you're no longer welcome. But United Methodist and Presbyterian and Lutheran, Episcopal, United Church of Christ, Disciples, there's a whole bunch of them. You can be a Universalist, and you're not ostracized. And in many cases, you're welcomed and even affirmed. So it's a different world than it was. We're making great progress compared to 150, 200 years ago in terms of just the faith that most churches teach is much more loving and benevolent than it was back then. And I think the Universalist element in all churches is having a big influence in that.
Hi, my name's Barb. I really appreciate your words this morning. And it helps me to know what you said today. It gives me a sense of power about not proselytizing. I don't believe in proselytizing. But as Universalists, I think we can be kind of timid to share our message and to share our beliefs. And I really appreciate your thoughts, because that has given me a new context in which to talk to other people who don't necessarily share my faith.
Yes. What you say, I'm glad you brought that up. In terms, I found that UUs are loving, kind, gentle people, and they're not pushy, and therefore they don't like to proselytize. In other words, be pushy and push their faith out on other people, and as a result, often don't say too much. But that's part of what motivates me to travel around the country speaking to UUs, is to let you know, or I trust you already know it, but to affirm that you have wonderful good news. The power of love is so important. And so you have good news, and you shouldn't ever feel that you're second-class people of faith, even though a lot of others are out there pushing it pretty hard, you know, on other people. You have something wonderful to share, and so it's good. You don't have to be pushy to share it. You can share it in a variety of ways without being pushy. So.
Thank you. Kaylin will be around, I think, for a little bit after the service if you've got any more comments you'd like to share with them. But at this time, the ushers will pass the baskets for our morning offertory. It's a reminder that our church is completely dependent on the generosity of its members, you, the congregation. Although in this high-tech age, many members give through electronic monthly transactions, even for those people, the offertory is a moment to reflect on how we finance ourselves and what we give to our community. And if you're visiting with us today, we consider you our guest, and so you don't need to feel compelled to give. We have a great deal more kindness than is ever spoken.
The whole human family is bathed with an element of love like a fine ether.
How many persons we meet in houses whom we scarcely speak to, whom we yet honor and who honor us?
how many we see in the street, or sitting in church, who move silently, and warmly rejoice to be with.
Read the language of these wandering eye beams.
The heart knoweth.
And our closing hymn is number 131. Please rise as you're willing and able. And byways, give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it, let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God.
Thank you.
to be.
Yeah.